Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris, and once again, Rick Sharg is joining us. Rick is an executive vice president at Carrington Mortgage Holdings, LLC. Rick is one of the nation's most frequently quoted sources on foreclosure, mortgage, and real estate trends, and has appeared on NBC Nightly News, CNN, CBS, NBC, ABC, CNBC, Fox, and NPR. Rick is a member of the board of directors of REOMAC and the president of the Technology Council of Southern California. Rick, we welcome you back.
Good to be here, Bruce.
When you buy in bulk, or actually whether you buy it in bulk or one at a time, does a company, Carrington, ever deal with sort of a smaller level of investor and off inventory to them? He asked with selfish intent.
You know, I don't think that was the original plan, but I do see that happen from time to time. And I'm also now seeing that smaller investors are bundling up small portfolios and offering them to us for sale.
Yeah, that's a reverse. That's interesting, isn't it?
And again, something I probably wouldn't have anticipated, but you know, given the dynamics of today's market and how hard it is to buy these assets in large numbers, you know, we're looking at all options.
So instead of you buying the big packages and downloading a certain portion to investors, it's actually working in reverse, where people are handing you smaller portfolios to ultimately get to the numbers you're interested in.
Yeah, which would have been exactly the opposite, as you pointed out, of what we would have expected to happen. But, hey, this market has been full of contradictions and surprises, so why should this be anything new?
It's the truth. I've never seen a market more challenging, and I'm surprised, honestly. I mean, our loan business counts on somebody being able to find something below market, and we're still very busy. And even the buying side of it, we've been able to shift what we buy. You know, we can't necessarily get in the way of somebody that wants to write a check for full price, but there's inventory that they're not interested in as well.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And you know, somebody was asking me if institutional purchasing was going to skew the entire market, and I had to gently point out that if there were 700,000 REOs nationally and investors bought all of them, compared to the 140 million residential properties out there, we're talking about a fraction of a percent of homes. It's not something we're all going to fundamentally change. But we have very specific criteria for the types of properties we're looking for which markets and within those markets, you know, which neighborhoods we really think make the most sense. Along those lines, we're very similar to your approach, Bruce. I know you don't go out and buy indiscriminately, and nor do we, and that's why it's going to probably take us a little longer to build up our portfolio than some other investors who are kind of doing more of a land grab.
You know, it really, when we look at what they buy, and let's say trustee sales, I mean, Carrington has certainly been active there, correct?
No, actually, we don't want to buy a trustee sales.
Never did?
Have not done that.
Okay, interesting.
Are not interested in being the company that buys properties with the intention of evicting people who are living there. It's just it doesn't feel right. And candidly, from an investor perspective, it's going to delay how long it takes you to deploy your capital in a cash flow property.
Okay, fair enough.
So no, we don't do. But we do see some of our competitors out there doing that. Yes,
and they're paying. They're paying a price where you kind of shake your head and go, okay, now why are you doing that? And it's interesting what you just said, maybe the answer, deploying capital at lightning speed to get a yield.
And that probably is why they're doing it, but I don't think, my suspicion is these are not companies who are terribly familiar with the foreclosure process or today's regulatory environment. If you're buying in the wrong state,
just because you have $500 million doesn't make you knowledgeable, does it?
It sure doesn't, which is surprising. I now understand the concept of dumb money. The But the reality is you can buy a property in a state that has a 365-day redemption period.
Exactly.
What do you do with that? Or a six-month eviction period. So if I'm deploying capital on behalf of one of our investors, I'd like the capital to start returning cash flow as quickly as possible. And the quickest way possible is to buy a house that's already vacant, their title's been cleared, and you know it's good to go.
I think what's interesting is the shift from lender rights to people in foreclosure rights. I mean, to me, that's been an astonishing adjustment that I'm not so sure won't have some unintended consequences for lenders going forward.
The lenders actually have rights?
I think they still do, but I know they've lost a lot of them.
I wonder sometimes what would motivate an investor to put funds into the mortgage market in today's regulatory environment.
You know, and that's kind of what I meant, is that, yeah. Okay, you really can't skew the rules. So we had a meeting, local city that I was part of, a foreclosure task force, and it was really part of the discussion was, okay, how do we use the city's power to force the lender to do, a series of things? And I had to, just raise up the point saying, do you really want to do that? Because if you're successful, the next loan will not happen. If you're telling me as a lender, I made an honest agreement and one of my rights is to pursue the property and you are now going to make that impossible or so expensive for me to pursue that it's not worth it, that I will never make another loan. And it's, you got to be careful because, it used to be that people felt pretty responsible for making the payments. And I think the last couple of years, they've been emboldened to think that they have the perfect right not to. And that's a scary transition.
There is some of that. And that's the moral hazard that the industry always talks about. I guess what's encouraging is that if you look at the surveys of borrowers who are upside down on their loan, over 90% of them are still current with their payments.
And that's a pretty amazing thing. It really is.
It actually is a pretty amazing thing when you stop to think about it. And like him or hate him, I think what Ed DeMarco is doing at the FHFA, kind of digging his heels in and saying we're not going to authorize large-scale principal balance reduction programs, really is trying to prevent having a government seal of approval that it's okay to break your contract. Now, having said that, we also have to be realistic and understand that if this were a commercial loan, the business would have no qualms whatsoever about breaking the contract and walking away if the terms had suddenly gone as bad as some of these homeowners' terms have gone.
But, okay, it's always been perfectly acceptable to not make your payment as long as the other side gets to pursue what their rights were on the property.
And that you're right, is where things start to unspool pretty wildly. But, it, when you look at that, probably not a huge surprise that you're seeing the large banks, who have become very convenient, if understandably unsympathetic, targets, bailing from mortgage origination. They're getting out of the mortgage lending business. And the largest ones are even getting out of the back end of the business where they were buying loans on the secondary market. So Bank of America's gone, Citi is gone, MetLife has exited the business entirely.
And Wells Fargo's taking over.
Well, Wells, if there weren't Wells Fargo right now, there would be no private market at all. It's interesting to see what's going on with the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau. A lot of what they're talking about sounds like common sense in terms of making sure borrowers understand what they're getting into and lenders trying to make sure that the borrowers can actually afford to pay for the loan. Who'd have ever thought we'd have to have that conversation? But it's how these things get regulated sometimes makes it very, very difficult to see how anybody's going to stay in the business.
One of the things that's definitely changed, and again, being a statistical nut, I love reading reports, and I'm excited that all you have to do is put PDF behind any subject matter that you want, and you can become pretty knowledgeable pretty fast. FHA, in 2007, 45% of their loans was to credit scores under 619, mm-hmm. And in 2011, 3%.
Right.
That's a very big shift in what really is the only aggressive lending policy, if you will, in the country, they're not loaning to the same people.
And the average FICO score for an FHA loan is now over 700.
And 740 for Fannie.
Yeah, and so that's what we were talking about in our previous conversation, is that the credit availability is very, very limited right now. It's difficult to get a loan. There's a lot of disenfranchised potential borrowers who would like to be back in the market, but simply don't qualify for those stipulations. And interestingly, a lot of the decision making is happening prior to FHA. A lot of the lenders are simply rejecting borrowers who technically qualify,
mm-hmm.
but they don't want to incur the risk and have FHA jump up on them if the loans go bad. Probably not a bad thing though, because FHA was running into some issues with its reserve fund. So having probably more qualification up front might be a necessary mid-course correction for them. But somebody's got to come along to serve that part of the market.
And until they do, that home ownership percentage has got no place to go but down.
You're absolutely right, and I do believe you will start to see products come to market from non-bank lenders that will require full documentation, that will require a significant down payment, but will have some degree of latitude in terms of things like debt-to-income ratios and credit scores. There are just too many people who would probably be good performing borrowers who simply can't get a loan right now, and there's too much inventory out there to see this just not happen at some point in the future.
Do you see any loosening up of loans to investors?
I would like to say yes, but I honestly, until there's a sea change probably in D.C., no, because investors still are painted as the villains of the last act, and hard to see any policy that's going to come out to make it easier to make funding available for investors. Having said that, there is a new version of hemp that's coming to market momentarily that for the first time does have some loan modification provisions for investment properties.
I did notice that. That is probably a step in the right direction. And one of the studies I read actually was very negative for investors' participation during the boom. I don't know if you read it. It was from the Fed, maybe New York Fed, and it had to do with what they thought the percentage of investors' participation was and what it actually turned out to be. They thought it was about 17%, but when they actually did a reverse search for properties that had gone through foreclosure, they found out that the people had not told the truth when they filled out their loan application. So you have a chart that shows 17% of people fessed up to say, I was going to not occupy the property, but in fact 50% of the loans were made to people that owned multiple properties.
Wow.
So that
when
was...
When I was with Realty Trek, we had taken a look at California and Nevada and compared the property address of homes in foreclosure to the mailing address of the owner.
Yeah.
Where the tax records would go.
Exactly.
And at one point, we were able to identify at least 40% of the homes in foreclosure were going to, had tax records going to a separate address. And we knew we weren't catching everybody because some were smarter than that. So it's not a huge surprise. And I think the words tend to take on meanings that they weren't originally intended for.
Mm-hmm.
One of my favorite lines from the movie The Princess Bride is Inigo Montoya telling the Sicilian, that word you keep using, I do not think it means what you think it means. And I think calling most of the people that got involved in that investors
in
the day,
yes,
is kind of an insult to investors everywhere. These were people that were trying to get rich quick and be the next Donald Trump without the bad hair.
It didn't even require them to own two houses. That speculative fever was for the owner-occupant, too.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Over financing your way into fame and fortune.
Yeah. And you know, right up to the guy that was refining out so he could buy three more. And it's interesting. You wanted them so bad that you were willing to you know, fib on your loan application about occupancy and, you know, what you were making. Now you fast forward to 2012 and they're on sale at 50% off, and, you know, they don't have enough, they really don't have enough buyers. One of the things that, you know, you have a lot of people with multiple capacity to buy, like a Carrington and lots of companies that are, you know, our size and, you know, in that range. But the owner-occupant, if you look at the math, how could there be a glut of those people on the sidelines? It has to be the least capable group of owner-occupant buyers ever.
It's certainly a group that is impeded. Whether they're qualified or not, in many cases, they're simply not going to meet the basic requirements.
Well, that's what I mean. In other words, with today's lender standards and with their debt and the odds of them, you know, in Riverside, I'll speak, you know, 45% of them already over-encumbered, they're not going to get a house. So there's just a lot of people that have been forced to the sidelines. And if you ever do decide to foreclose on the properties that are upside down that are not making payments and you do it in any quantity, I think you'd find out that your list of buyers would be very, very much short the necessary quantity. I really do.
I think you're right. And I think if you look at home building trends, I think the home builders recognize that as well. There's just so little going on in terms of single family starts that, and then really very, very localized growth, that I think that tells you all you need to know. If there were ample buyers out there to facilitate a recovery, you would see more home building going on than you're currently seeing.
And I think a chart that's equally as important is the subdivision creation. It's non-existent. Riverside County, 300 subdivisions a year, probably going from 2000 to 2008. And in 2011, there was 11 subdivisions. That tells you the optimism of a builder.
That's an amazing statistic.
Yeah, there's, in other words, they don't see any way they can pencil anything new. Now you might see building go up, but they're buying an existing lot for nothing, and so even a building start doesn't tell you the truth. A subdivision creation does, because it says, okay, from scratch, I am optimistic I can sell for a profit.
Right.
And that isn't happening.
No.
Do you see anything in the legislative world that could be pretty either positive or ominous for real estate in the next year?
I think the ultimate implementation of Dodd-Frank and what it means to the mortgage market has potential to be very problematic in terms of unintended consequences and making it prohibitive for people to actually deliver mortgages. Even something as obscure as Basel III requirements that are going to require banks to lock up so much capital for what they loan and what loans they service, that it's going to cause a lot of those institutions to get out of the business. I think those are some of the issues. A lot of the chatter about some other housing related issues, eliminating the mortgage interest deduction from taxes, those sorts of things seem to have fallen by the wayside.
Really?
At least we don't hear a lot about them at the moment.
Well, that's because we're not going to deal with our tax problem until 2013.
That's right. This is an election year, isn't it?
That's right. Yeah, so we can't do anything substantive until later.
So, no, I really haven't heard a whole lot legislatively. Now, in the state of California, you do have another issue, which is the Home Buyer's Bill of Rights that the legislature and Attorney General Harris are trying to push through. And when the FHFA comes out against something called the Homeowner's Bill of Rights,
mm-hmm.
You suspect that maybe there are some flaws in the proposition.
They might have gone just a tad too far.
A tad too far, yeah.
Well, you know, that's the thing, you know, and that's what's interesting about a business like Carrington has. You buy a trust deed that you've read and you actually think you understand what your rights are, and then, lo and behold, by the time you get to the finish line, wow.
So, well, there's actually, and this is happening in California as well, there's another company that is working with a couple counties and encouraging them to use eminent domain to not claim properties, but to claim underwater mortgages. So they would basically just go to the bank or the investor that holds the mortgage and use eminent domain to take ownership of these loans. away from the banks, away from the lenders, and then hand them off to this company for the, you know, theoretically to rework the loans and see if they can't get modifications for folks. But the fact that there are municipalities actually considering that kind of government intervention,
wow,
tells you how and what that would basically do is shut down any mortgage industry in California indefinitely.
You know,
because you'd have no idea what you'd own.
Right. That's the thing. You would just really be scared of writing the next check and saying, okay, you just wouldn't do the loan. And
nope.
You're right. It would be, I don't know why they don't think about that. And what happens, I'm sure, I mean, we just had basically the Great Depression, at least in our industry.
Mm-hmm.
That definitely has hit real estate. And so you could understand why they think, okay, we need more regulation. But some of the things that they're talking about being necessary, let's say inside of Dodd-Frank, making a 20% down payment mandatory, I know you've seen the same studies I have where that doesn't really affect the payment performance as nearly as much as you'd think it would.
No, it really doesn't. These are, look, I people are trying to do the right thing. Unfortunately, they're doing it without a lot of information.
I don't understand that. I mean, honestly, who do they, don't they have access to anybody that they want to talk to?
There's a breakdown of trust. And anything coming out from the financial services industries right now is looked upon as tainted.
Wow.
And it's a shame, but I think, unfortunately, it's just where we are at the moment. And it's going to take a while to dig out of that hole.
I think it's already begun to happen. So Dodd-Frank is, you know, being nibbled at as we speak. So it's probably written, actually, maybe it wasn't written. It was sort of, I'm confused about Dodd-Frank, to be honest with you. It's probably like, here's the broad brush. Now you guys go create it and then let's beat it up. And
well, it's 1,400 pages of loosely related stuff. Some of which contradicts itself.
Right, and so you end up with layers and layers of stuff that gets in the way of common sense, and that's what's missing.
Here's the other thing I would add to that, though, Bruce. The industry has been tone deaf for a long time, and I've talked to some fairly high level executives in the industry to talk about this too, what we're missing as an industry is we are not going in and speaking in a language that resonates with the legislators, with the regulators. If you can go in and show that the regulators and legislators don't care that this is going to cost an institution more money,
mm-hmm,
or make it difficult for them to do business,
right?
If you can go in and say this is going to make it more difficult for your voter to get a loan,
mm-hmm,
and may make it impossible for some of your constituents to ever buy a house, then you'll get their attention.
Okay.
But if you go in and say, this is a bad law because it hurts my business, they actually might look at that as a net
perfect
positive. Yeah.
That's perfect. That's our intent. We're going to get you guys back.
And then don't kid yourself. There is some of that going on.
Oh, right? No. That's why I said it. Absolutely. There's got to be some payback that the intention of we let you guys kind of run amok, and you did. A little less than a minute. How do you view 2012 and then 2013?
I think 2012 is the year we finally bottom out and begin the slow, arduous crawl back to some sort of real estate recovery. And I look at 2013 as being pretty flat on a national basis in terms of both sales volume and sales prices.
You know, Rick, isn't it interesting? I stay up now and watch to see if Greece is going to stop making their payments and if Spain's going to get their loan. And it's just much more difficult than it's ever been to try to be a successful real estate investor because you've now got so much to look at that you never had to before.
There are things that we are so far out of our control.
Yeah, that's it.
That it's almost impossible to forecast. And there's things that are closer to home. Chairman Bernanke talking about the economy falling off a cliff in January if tax cuts are allowed to expire,
yeah,
and mandatory cuts all hit at the same time. So yeah, the Chinese curse worked. We're all living in interesting times.
Rick, thanks so much for joining us. Rick Sharga, Executive Vice President of Carrington Mortgage Holdings, LLC.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.